We're trying to get this as a constant thing in the symposium. If I seem a little rattled, I've been at the tape table, and I am rattled. Well, the tape, there was evidently an announcement in the program that tapes would be available 30 minutes after the session. Forget that, okay? That never happened. I've got a son back there who's working very hard to get the tapes out as quickly as we can, and so if you come up and I'm there and you're mean to my son, you're going to get it. That's right, her son's back there too, so you better watch out for the mamas back there. We're going to get you. I really do welcome you here. We've got, I think, a really fun session for you. Let me just introduce the panel. First of all, you're going to hear from Hal Cannon. He is the artistic, is that what you said? Director of the Western Folklife Center in Elko. He also has been playing with the Deseret String Band. I'm sure many of you are familiar with that. He graciously consented to come down here for this. His daughter is here. He really wants to be with her. And so I'm very thrilled that he gave us his time today, and I think he'll enjoy him immensely. Susan Howe was supposed to give me a little thing. Okay, can I say you work at BYU?
Yeah.
Okay. No, forget that. She's not an assistant professor at BYU of English. Mm-mm. She is a poet. She's the poetry editor for Dialogue. And she has published in The New Yorker and in many other publications, has won awards. Again, I appreciate her continuing to be on this panel. She's a delightful person and a wonderful writer. Brian Waterman is on the staff at Sunstone. He's an associate editor also with me. Since his name starts with W and mine starts with an E, I get to go first. And he is, I've gotten to know Brian this summer, and just a real kick to have him in the office. Carol Quist is also on the staff of Sunstone, and also a real kick, let me tell you. She's kept things pretty well organized back behind the desk this time, and we're really glad to have her. Albert Peck is supposed to be here. Where is he? Is he trying to avoid coming in here? He did this to me last year. Okay. Anyway, Albert Peck is not here. Then Doc Taylor is... I heard about Doc Taylor through James Arrington. Evidently, he's just a very humorous fellow, and I'm really excited to have him here. He's a music engraver, composer, and arranger. He's also the copy chief of the Utah County Journal, and I just feel really happy. Did I say that right?
Yes.
Okay. Because we had Cal Grandal being from the Orem Standard Examiner, so I want to make sure I have that right. Anyway, so please welcome our poets and our humorists, and get ready for a good time.
I'm going to play the guitar first, just to this is humorous music rather than poetry, just to start with. I know it's not on the session, but I just want to play a tune that I've been working on. That's an old dance tune from Parowan, Utah. We found a handwritten manuscript of dance tunes from Parowan a few years ago, and I've been going through and learning some of them. And I'm so excited about it, I just wanted to play one. Thank you. I guess the reason I wanted to play that is to talk a little bit about folk art before I read a poem or two. Folk art is generally fairly simple forms. That tune was just a real simple AABB ballad type tune. It's really the musical equivalent of most folk poetry, which is written in meter and simple rhyme scheme. And I'm a great lover of folk art, and there's a lot of richness in Mormon folk art of the past, and it's simple stuff. And I'm going to do a few poems and songs, if I could. First, I'd like to read a poem that's not a Mormon poem. It's a cowboy poem. I've been listening to Sunstone Symposium on the radio for the last 2 days driving from Nevada. It takes a long time. And the signal was coming through loud and clear from the top of the Pequops Inn. And so I've been listening, and I'd like to report a very male conversion story. I was on the drive in 80 working under Silver Jack, which the same is now in Jackson and ain't soon expected back. And there was a fellow amongst us by the name of Robert Waite, kind of cute and smart and tonguey. Guess he was a graduate. He could talk on any subject from the Bible down to Hoyle, and his words flowed out so easy, just smooth and slick as oil. He's what they call a skeptic. And he loved to sit and weave highfalutin words together, telling what he didn't believe. One day was sitting around, smoking black plug tobacco and hearing Bob expound. Hell, he said, was all humbug. And he made it plain as day that the Bible was a fable, and he allowed it look that way. Miracle was such like and too rank for him to stand, and as for them that they called the Savior, he was just a common man. You're a liar, someone shouted, and you've got to take it back. Then everybody started. 'Twas the words of Silver Jack. And he cracked his fists together and he stacked his duds and cried, 'Twas in that religion my mother lived and died, and though I haven't always used the Lord exactly right, yet when I hear a chump abuse him, he's got to eat his words or fight. Now this Bob, he weren't no coward, and so he answered bold and free, stack your duds and cut your capers, for there ain't no flies on me. And they fit for 40 minutes, and the crowd would whoop and cheer when Jack spit up a tooth or two, or Bobby lost an ear. But at last Jack got him under, and he slugged him once or twice, and straightway Bob admitted in the divinity of Christ. But Jack kept reasoning with him, till the poor cuss gave a yell, and lo'd he'd been mistaken in his views concerning hell. Then the fierce encounter ended, and they riz up from the ground, and someone brought out a bottle, and which he kindly passed around. And we drank to Bob's religion, and the cheerful sort of way, and the spread of infidelity was checked in camp that day. I'll sing one that is, I think, one of the great pieces of Mormon folk literature. It's a song that was written during the Dixie Mission called Once I Lived in Cottonwood. And it's the story of one man's experience going to the Dixie Mission, George Hicks. Oh, once I lived in Cottonwood and owned a little farm. When they called me down to Dixie, it caused me much alarm.
To hoe the cane and cotton, I right away must go. But the reason why they sent me, I'm sure I do not know. I hooked up Jim and Bolly, all four to make a start. But to leave my house and garden, it almost broke my heart. We moved along quite slowly, oft times we looked behind. For the rocks and hills of Dixie kept rolling through my mind. First we reached the Black Ridge, where I broke my wagon down. I couldn't find a carpenter, I was 20 miles from town. So I cut a clumsy cedar and made an awkward slide. But the wagon pulled so heavily, poor Betsy could not ride. While Betsy was a-walkin', I told her to take care. When all upon a sudden she struck a prickly pear. Then she began to blubber and she began to bawl. Crying if I was back in Cottonwood, I wouldn't have come at all. Next we got to Washington, where we stayed a little while, to see if April showers could make the verdure smile. But at last I was mistaken, and so we went away. For the red hills of November look just the same in May. I am so weak and hungry now, there's nothing here to cheer, except prophetic sermons, which we very often hear. They hand them out by the dozen and prove them by the book. But me, I'd like some roast veneers to stay at home and cook. I am so weak and hungry now, I think I'm nearly dead. 'Tis 7 weeks next Sunday since I've tasted bread. Of carrot tops and lucerne greens, I've had enough to eat. Boys, I'd like to change my diet to buckwheat cakes and meat. Well, I brought this old coat with me about 2 years ago. And how I'll get another one, I'm sure I do not know. May protect me against the wind and wet. These times for me and Betsy, I'm sure I won't forget. This shirt was dyed with wild dock root with greasewood for a set. I'm sure the colors, they will fade when once it does get wet. They said we could grow madder here and indigo so blue. That proved out a humbug, the story was not true. My wagon went for sorghum seeds to make a little bread. Poor old Jim and Bolly long ago are dead. There's just me and Betsy left to hoe the cotton tree. May heaven protect the Dixieite wherever he may be.
One more. After this, I go into my mother's poetry, modern, contemporary folk poetry. A song now to sing all my kind friends before me. I've been thinking of late a new subject I'd raise, and the one I have got, and I hope it will suit you. I'm going to sing of our grandfather's days. In our grandfather's days, men were judged by their merit, and those who were sound got their portion of praise. But nowadays folks judge a man by his money. That wasn't the style in our grandfather's days. In our grandfather's days there were no patent leathers, giro choking collars, nor peg top pants. And the boy didn't go it on 240 horses, nor visit the girls at night at their aunt's. And the girls didn't then pinch their breasts out with cotton, didn't wear tilted hoops, patent bustles nor stays, didn't smoke cigarettes nor drink cocktails at stores. That wasn't the style in our grandfather's days. In our grandfather's days, when a man ran for office, he did it alone for the nation's own good, and not for the dollars and cents he might pocket. That's something that nowadays it isn't understood. The government then was for wisdom selected. Rebellion had not set our nation ablaze, but the people had pledged that the flag would wave over the land as it did in our grandfather's day.
hard to follow. First, I would like to say this is really nice as a participant in the same session last year and a participant in the session this year. Our audience has grown 500%. And so I take that as a very good sign. Being less and less variously talented than Hal, I have one mere poem. And it's called A Parable, How Crows Winter at My University. You will recall my university, the one where I work, is the large university in Provo, Utah. And, you know, I don't know if it's funny or just bitter. But you can listen to it. It has an epigraph from Milan Kundera from his book, The Unbearable Lightness of Being, which you should all go read. This is an incredible book. This is what's happening. The epigraph is this. Kitsch is the absolute denial of shit. And if you read the book, you'll understand. It's true and it's profound, although it may not sound like it. Okay, here we go. This institution has rules of Christian appearance. No beards on men, no provocative sexual display. The grounds, too, abide certain standards. So winter crows, returning as faithfully as the brash, unbroken students who show up each fall, unsettle the campus with their dark impieties. Late afternoon, they flap in, hundreds scratching the sky. They teeter on top limbs, lift and settle again, home for the night. Then, all those dark hours, they shit. And their droppings fall on the university. A possible judgment of nature the current administration righteously resists. To correct such behavior, a grounds crew flies up in a crane, ties to high branches owls tearing crows with their claws, terror as false and convincing as an orthodox education. That day, the live birds come in, deflect and scatter, dark blotches spreading on the pale skin of the sky. The university once again advertises itself pristine, intact. It is weeks before one punished bird straggles back, courageous, stupid, or tired beyond life, and alights one branch from an owl. Nothing happens. Others follow. The secret is out, and all the crows, cozy, forgiving, come home to roost, perch on the plaster heads, do their business as usual. So, one January morning, 10 below zero, speakers appear bolted to the administration building walls. What cunning has devised these circuits that shriek and wail? This demon screech interrupted and repeated till it pierces the dark heads, till the feathers shake under the body's condemnation, and the black eyes see all who are punished in the world. The crows rise and fly at the dawn, absorbed in the blinding light. They never come back. The rest of the winter is vacant, the grounds an empty field, trees prisoned in ice. Only the pesky students, themselves falling in line or out of the way, miss the birds, the noise. They gather in courtyards, scan the evening sky. Listen for the nuance outside the haze, one says. Hear that? They have to send their minds so far to account for the crows, for the hope of bringing them back, that perhaps they imagine the voices, the cacophony as rich and complex as the moral this poem hopes to have. But occasionally they do hear, tinny and cracked, the earthy ethereal chorus as ca, 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 and ca breaks through the brittle dusk. You crows, you.
Well, if Sue had less talent, then we're getting less and less and less, because I'm not using any of mine. When Marty asked me if I would read a poem in this, the first funny Mormon poem, actually it was the only funny Mormon poem I could think of, just popped right into my head. And I know it from the second installment of Dennis Clark's The State of Mormon Poetry, which was an award-winning essay he did in four parts in Sunstone a few years ago. And it has a really neat cover. That's one of them. You should buy all four of those issues. Because they pay me. Anyway, I'll read this one, and then I have a couple others from a different source. This is by R.A. Christmas, and it's called In Mormon Heaven. In Mormon Heaven, you get to make babies, and God is the president. There ain't no bad niggers, homos, or hippies. Everybody shaves and believes in the same thing. Even B. Young and Port Rockwell, your neighbors just down the street. And someday, your wife's gonna let you take those cute girls next door to a Disney flick, where you'll fall in love, and after that you'll get married and married and have zillions of kids who will always, always obey. Yeah. I don't know if that one's funny or just bitter either. The other two that I want to read come from, let's see, on Thursday I gave a talk on the poetry of Louisa Barnes Pratt, who's my fourth great grandmother, and she's, some people say that she was the first woman missionary in the church. The first time her autobiography was published, that was the title, you know, the first Mormonism's first woman missionary. She was set apart by Brigham Young because after about her husband's umpteenth mission, she told him that if he got called again and didn't take the family, then she was going to find a new husband. So immediately on that demand, he set her apart and sent her after her husband to the islands. To give an idea of who Louisa is, meaning what her personality is like, I'll read two excerpts from her journal, and then I'll read from her poems. In May 1846, they were on their way out of Nauvoo, and her husband was on his mission. He was on his first mission still to the Society Islands, and so she was taking her four daughters by herself across the plains. She writes, "We soon camped near a creek. Our friends overtook us at this place, and the camp was organized. The brethren met by themselves, organized, and chose a president without the aid or counsel of the women. This evening, the sisters propose to organize themselves into a distinct body, to prove to the men that we are competent to govern ourselves. If they set the example of separate interests, we must help carry it out." And on June 7th, she writes, which is just a week or so later, "Last evening, the ladies met to organize. Mrs. Isaac Chase was called to the chair. She was also appointed president by a unanimous vote. Mrs. L.B. Pratt, who she's the one writing, was called counselor and scribe. Several resolutions were adopted. First, resolved that when the brethren call on us to attend prayers, get engaged in conversation and forget what they called us for. That the sisters retire to some convenient place, pray by themselves, and go about their business. Second, if the men wish to hold control over the women, let them be on the alert. We believe in equal rights." So that's who Louisa is. When she was in her later years, she was separated from her husband, and she lived in southern Utah, and he lived in California. He didn't want to come back to Utah. He could never reconcile himself to the concept of polygamy. From both of these people, I see where I get my blood. This is called Song by L.B. Pratt, which she wrote for the dedication of a Relief Society house. And I've tried to think of Mormon tunes that it could possibly have been sung to, and the only one I could think of is A Poor Wayfaring Man of Grief. But I'm not going to sing it. Maybe Hal will sing it later or something. But this could be sung to that tune. I have no idea what tune they did sing it to, but this was for a Relief Society house dedication. She was in her either late 70s or early 80s when she wrote this. We've met, dear sisters, on this day to talk and sing and preach and pray, to do the best in all we can without the help of any man. Then here's to all who have contended and boldly woman's rights defended. I know the scripture plainly says that man the head of woman is. It also does as plain declare that they on us dependent are. Here's to the man who will surrender his white rights to woman and defend her. And I think she means defend her rights, not defend her physically. Men wish us all to understand we must obey when they command. This law will serve a timid wife. Old maids and widows, no such strife. So here's to those who live in freedom and prove to men they do not need 'em. She goes on and on with that song. There's like a million verses. But the other one was written for, it's called the Centennial Party, 24 July 1876, which was a joint Independence Day, the Centennial of the United States Centennial, and also it was a Pioneer Day celebration in Beaver. And this is what she has to say about it. She kind of gets in to introduce the scene, and then she says, "The program was fixed, and all to our mind, each guest would contribute to make up the kind. Our next friend, Mr. Wicker, a very nice man, he thought 'twould be better to alter the plan. On such grand occasion, t'would be very fine to treat the whole crowd to some good Dixie wine. He showed his good will, and I would not dare say he drank too freely today. Toward the close of the meeting, a lady took leave. It amused us to see the poor fellow grieve. At first he seemed faint. He began soon to cough. We began to be fearful that he might drop off. We tried to console him, but all was in vain. Till we got him to dance Miss Tucker again. We said, 'Oh, don't mind about the absent lady. For your own dear self, now a woman she'll be.' So he donned a sunbonnet, and I would have said, 'Indeed, Miss Walker, you're a handsome old maid.' She cheered up once. And remember, this is really Mr. Walker, but he's wearing the bonnet and drunk and dancing around. She cheered up at once. Her cough grew lighter. She danced more graceful. Her eyes, they looked brighter. The gentlemen all in the room then began. Each said he would rather be woman than man. The ladies consented, to tell you the fact. It made us laugh loud to see how they would act. Mr. Crosby made music. Though not feeling well, what made him grow better, we plainly could tell. The ladies took hats," and she's meaning all of the women's husbands, "the ladies took hats, and they did look so fine. Miss Walker thought best to take some more wine. She played on the banjo. We drank round a glass. The music was thanked for what he'd brought to pass. And likewise, the hostess, for being polite, to our credit, will say nobody got light." I wonder if that means too drunk. "A more merry affair I never did see than the homemade centennial wine party-e." And she spells party, P-A-R-T-E-E, to rhyme visibly with C and... agree, and I think she was drunk when she wrote it. But that one never was included in her journal, though. So.
I am not a teacher at BYU either, but I am at Salt Lake Community College in the English department. Who's lucky? I don't know. I love it there, though. I'm going to read you a five-liner to begin with, and then a sonnet. If we have more time to do more things, I will do more things. This is called Sit Splits. Sit Splits. Why don't psychologists rush to research humanity's spatial behavioral smirch, in parentheses, a lapse too long left in the clinical lurch, close paren, the penchant persisting of people to perch in back on the bus, in front on the bus and in back of the church. Let's hear it again. Why don't psychologists rush to research humanity's spatial behavioral smirch, a lapse too long left in the clinical lurch, the penchant persisting of people to perch in front on the bus and in back at the church? This is called Tenet Net. tenet meaning, I'm a teacher, this is the holler out part of class. Tenet meaning doctrines or principles or rules. Okay.
Yeah.
Tenet, net. Shakespeare in sonnet. The scriptures hold that heaven tenders rest, where earthly wants no longer worry souls. In realms that shower balm upon each breast, and mold low fragments into lofty wholes. And pastors preach of garlands for the brow, fair atmospheres of music for the ear, full honeyed fruit upon each golden bough, and angel guides forever wafting near. The Spirit also whispers of rewards in everlasting domes of love and light, of blessings all eternity affords to humans who adhere to rule and right. If paradise is all these testify, more mortals should be more inclined to die.
This is going quickly. Well, I'm real pleased to be here. I was a bit frightened when I got the catalog, the program in the mail, because I opened it up and it said Spiritual Sensual Confluence, Five Poets on the Edge, and I quickly looked down and was relieved not to see my name there. Because I'm on the edge, but I try to keep it, you know, a secret. I've never written a poem in my life, and certainly don't intend to start now. But I'm very fond of doggerel. I think we all are very privileged to have English as our mother tongue, one of the great, great languages of the earth, and particularly suited to doggerel. I think doggerel does something to English that no other language can quite bear to have done to it. Gilbert and Sullivan converted me to that philosophy. They say talk is cheap and doggerel's a pretty good bargain. And when it's good, people are pleasantly surprised. And when it's bad, people aren't disappointed. And what more can you ask? So, and when Marty called me, I thought, yeah, I'll write a few Mormon things. And sure enough, I did. I started at 11 this morning. So here's one of them. That's the other good thing about doggerel. This is called What's in De Name. In the good old days before the modern maze of the rat race enveloped our world, when a baby arrived, it was simple as pie to name it, especially a girl. They would take a name they would give to a boy and give it a feminine swirl. Edwina and Charlotte, Georgette and Eustacia, and other mutations fit to give you aphasia. Like Thomasina and Ralphette, and Drusilla and Wilhelmina, and worst of all, Orgilla. Except for the French, who were always contrary and named their boys things like René, Michelle, and Mary. But in Utah today, we've a different solution. It's written somewhere in the state constitution. Just add a few letters. It's simple enough. Just add on a fix. Use a pre, not a suff. Laverl, Lavon, Ladweezel, LaRue. La Bamba, La Tammy. La Fifi, La Du. La Cletus, La Wanda. La Bubba, La Pew. Or if you prefer, and the baby's a he, instead of a la, you just add on a D. Devon and Dewayne, De Ralph and De Roscoe, De Marvin, De Mortimer, De Aloysius and De Bosco. I hope this poem will some wisdom lend, for here's de conclusion, de finish, de end. Thank you. And here's another one I penned this morning on Mormon poetry. There's just one trick, the poet said, to writing Mormon poetry. Oh, tell me, master, tell me do, I implored him. I will, he said in a secretive tone, if you keep it twixt you and me. First find a meter, an inner pulse beater, a sing-songing 1, 2, 3. Be more twitty than witty. Use more bathos than pathos. And your poem will be Mormon, you'll see. And if you can, mention in poetic invention the word genealogy. But the real key, he said with glee, to writing Mormon poetry, make sure you rhyme every other line with the word eternity. That's it for that one. Thank you. This is one I wrote as a dedication to a book some years ago for a friend. And it kind of turned doggerel around. It deliberately does not rhyme. I think you'll very quickly catch on. I always knew it would happen sometime. I always knew there'd come a day when I'd come up against the impossible rhyme, when nothing would go my direction. My mind in a whirligig flounders about with the problem this quandary poses. It makes me so angry that I could just scream, because everything's coming up pansies. It's hard to be blunt and yet get to the point and strive all your troubles to shirk, when as Shakespeare had said, the time's out of sync and nothing seems to function. But now I must conclude this lay, this book in time to sin. Besides, I ask, what more can I speak except this is the finish? That's it. Thank you. I also wrote a bit of, what do they call these things? What are those little nasty poems called? The name suddenly escaped. Limerick. But this one's not nasty. But it doesn't rhyme either. There was a young lady named Laurie who was neither a Whig nor a Democrat. We all chuckled with glee when she turned 34, and that is the end of the tale. Okay, this one I think you'll like. I regard these next two poems as kind of my magnum opera. These were pulled at great effort from the wood that is there. Fruitcake, I think, is one of the most awful things ever devised by the mind and hand of man. And I'm really convinced it was cooked sometime in late winter in the 1200s when everything was going rotten and the mother-in-law was coming over and they said, what can we cook? And I consider it kind of dessert phlegm. So, as the comic said, I found a hair in my fruitcake and it was the best part of the cake. So this is called Praise the Lord and Mail the Fruitcake. Praise the Lord and mail the fruitcake. This old gray moose is dead. 'Tis not for us this petrified Egyptian mummy bread. Oh, good my wife, take from me, please, this wretched cake of Damocles. This baleful brick its shadow dread go cast on someone else's head. And who said you didn't get classical illusion in doggerel, huh? I tried one once when I was small and still quite young and callow. The pungent bunt seemed made of gall and rotten fruit and tallow. With stomach clenched and palate braced, I swallowed with unseemly haste, but still could not avoid the taste of brackish, fruity, toxic waste. I gave some fruitcake to the cat. He didn't pause or tarry, but straightaway began to dig. They know just what to bury. So put it in the mail, and you'll spoil somebody else's yule, for though this may seem somewhat cruel, 'twill rid us of this jilted gruel. So pack it off and do not worry. I'm sure the one who gets this slurry will send it on. Yes, I'm afraid he's going to mail this cake of Hades on and on. And so it goes, and where it stops, nobody knows. Mail on, thou chip of hate, mail on. Thank you. And I think to save you, I will skip over the dread Orioles of Borneo. Oh, well, I'll read a bit of it here. The Orioles of Borneo are made from human heads. And though the heads are shornio, I'd never eat that bread. The Oreos of far Japan are made of day-old sushi. And though they bake them till they're tan, they still taste rather gushy. The Oreos of Madagascar of jungle plants are made of mangoes found by fearless Lascars and fungi grown in shade. The Oreos of the Argentine are made of llama hide and sausages long kept in brine. A roach-shaped one, he died. But here we're much more civilized, our recipe specific. Our Oreos are realized through methods scientific. What is it, Carrie Wiseman asked, that makes her crave this cookie? This doesn't seem too hard a task. My friend, let's take a looky. You have no shame in doggerel either. That's important. Rhyme with anything. To token bits of real food, fell chemicals are mated, BHT and BHA and oil hydrogenated. And other dread preservatives tossed in by cookie mongers. No matter how long you live, these cookies will live longer. The chocolate cookie outsides bear the Oreo initials, made not of wheat but of the tares and flavors artificial. While inside lurks the whited cream, the part that's eaten first, with piggy lard and sugar teams and other things still worst. Oh, Father, these scientific ways revile us, recipes I probe. They turn me from a cookie file into a cookie phobe. Thank you. Okay, now I have one more I wrote this morning, and then the grand work, I think. Where did I put that other one I wrote? I reeled these all out of my computer. Here we go. Hannibal, the Carthaginian, and all his many minions and hordes of ponderous pachyderms could never have dictated terms to a crowd of mingling Mormons. Napoleon, who conquered Europe, would have stood impotent in his stirrups, and mighty handsome Alexander, for all he might get up his dander, could have only twiddled his thumbs. The Emperor and Alex the Great, like everyone else, would have to wait for a crowd of mingling Mormons. Marshal your armies, ye leaders of old, assemble ye Xerxes and Caesars, muster your legions, that all be stopped cold by a couple of old Mormon geezers. Be grim and be solemn, advance by the column, advance by the rank, try to take them in flank. With bayonets flashing and armor a-jingling, you'll never get through when Mormons are mingling. And then, this one is a parody of the poem Jabberwocky, which I'm sure you all are well acquainted with. This is another fruitcake poem called Fruity Schlocky. 'Twas bilious, and the slimy nodes were dire and thimble in the cake. All flimsy were the fruity loads, and the gnomes lasted quick. Beware the fruity cake, my son, the cake that sweats the fruits that catch. Beware the glabrous brick, and shun the luminous pander trash. He took his vorpal fork in hand, long time the jellied cake he sought. So rubbed he on his tum-tummy, and stood a while in thought. And as in queasy thought he stood the fruity cake, with fruits of shame came oozing through the tulgy wood, and sweated as it came. 1, 2, 1, 2, and hue and few, the vorpal fork went squishy smack. He left it dead, and with its head he went galumping back. And hast thou slain the fruity cake? Go take a bath, thou squeamish boy. O scabrous fray, aru allay, he snorkeled in his joy. 'Twas bilious, and the slimy nodes were dire and thimble in the cake. All flimsy were the fruity loads, and the gnomes last did quake. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, what I did before were some of the old folk poetry, but I think, as all of you who have grown up in the Mormon church know, there's an unofficial poet laureate probably in every ward, and I grew up in being the son of the poet laureate of our ward, and every road show, about 3 or 4 months before the road show would begin, my mother would start putting new words to Broadway musicals and writing scripts for road shows. And when anyone in the ward was married, my mother would write poetry at the showers and before the weddings and for funerals and such. And last night I was asking my mother if she kept this material, and she brought out a folder of material over the years that was probably this thick. And I'm not going to comment on the quality of the poetry, but I know that commemorative poetry has been very important for our ward and for the community that I grew up in. So I'll just read you a few. It's not very funny, but it's great stuff. The bride and groom in this romance step with very talented toes, she lightly kicking towards heaven, his kick straight to the target goes. This is a bride who loves beauty with a taste for buttons and bows, who profits by teaching dancing from jazz to arabesque on her toes. This groom is a specialist in football, earns a scholarship with his toes as he punts the ball into motion where straight to the goal it goes. Anyway, it goes on and on.
But it's about, a football player and my niece, who is a ballerina. And then I'll just read a little bit of a poem that, this is, I guess, from a road show about quilting. And it's sort of interesting, because I think some other things come out in her poem. Besides just going to try to find the equipment to set up the quilting frame for the women in the ward. Everybody likes a story, and the story we shall tell of a closet. Yes, a closet, where the skeletons are many, yet upon them you'll not dwell. In the closet, every time you want a thumbtack, you should not be too much concerned, but you sooner or later learn. If you want to get a thumbtack, just run over to the store. You'll be better off for more. And then she goes, oh, we don't need all these buttons and these beads and bits of bray. In the closet. If we keep on storing bottles, the police are apt to raid. Pretty bottles in the closet. Won't you come and stand beside me while with courage I lift and through all the junk I'll sift? Oh, we'll find the tacks and the tissue and the hammers and the glue. Will some daring things do? So that's a sampling of my mom's poetry. I'm going to play another one of these tunes from Perwin, if I may. No, they're dance tunes. Yeah. This one's called Doc Kammerer's Favorite. Another one. This is called Two Friends Quadrille.
I saw in a costume shop, on a costume shop billboard this week, an ad for Halloween things, and I knew that Christmas was nearly here, and that it was time for me to get out my Christmas verses that I've been working on, and my New Year's verses, and since it is August, would be appropriate to try some of them out on you, and perhaps you can make some good additions. I will not sing them, but you all know of these tunes, and they will probably roll around in your head. This is called How Now, Noel. Modernized carols to sing along. I'm going to read some first stanzas. The first Noel, the eager did say, was before Halloween by a week and a day. Angels we have heard on high tell us what and where to buy. Sleigh bells ring and we're listening till our eardrums are glistening. Away in a manger hides Junior's new bike, trike, and also a 10-speed his sister will like. I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, as are 100 ski resorts, where the owner's strokes on the wealthy folks on the slopes is what makes winter sports. Oh, come, all ye faithful Christmas Club subscribers. Line up, combine up, and sign up again. All I want for Christmas is described below. Add batteries to make them go. Have a holly jolly Christmas. Bills will not be issued now. They'll appear sometime next year to cause a family row. We three kings of Orient are. UPS sends our gifts afar. Once in Royal David's City, TV crews monopolized the scene, but a government committee sold commercials in between. Deck the halls with plastic holly, artificial trees, and balsam spray. Living symbols seem such folly. Serve some phony food to fit the day. Here comes Santa Claus, helicoptering, or by parachute. Girls and boys charge games and toys from stores along his route. While shepherds watch their flocks by night, Yule tree lot guards watch too, to keep their festive wares from sprouting feet and breaking through. Break forth, O beauteous heavenly light, to halo shopping centers, and radiate all day and night for customers and renters. O little town of Bethlehem, how still we saw thee lie until the corps of publicists began to amplify. Good King Wenceslas looked out for snowballers roundabout. Jolly old St. Nicholas, lean your ear this way. Smile once more, then we'll be through for photos for today. I'll be home for Christmas, or marooned en route, late today, warn AAA to mobilize pursuit. Oh Christmas tree, you were so lush and burly. Oh Christmas tree, why did you shed so early? Hark the herald angels sing, now half price on everything. Rudolph the red-nosed reindeer proved that critters can buy friends, but when he loses wattage, adoration quickly ends. Up on the housetop, reindeer paws, quite defying zoning laws. It came upon the midnight clear what I should have bought for my dear. Silent night, holy night, all is wrapped, floors of fright. The chorus. Jingle bells, rock and jazz and jive. God rest ye merry, gentlemen. The kids will rise at 5. Now, here's your New Year's resolution. Here's your new Year's news. New Year's news. This coming year, I loudly vow to swear more than I'm doing now. And when on truth the rest rely, I pledge to always alibi. I promise with the greatest zeal to never buy what I can steal. And furthermore, I firmly plan to criticize the most I can. Last, due to Santa broke and beat, I'll start on his accounts to cheat. And those deploring my volutions don't know how I keep resolutions.
Thank you. I'm Melvin Hipwell. To be audacious, if you ask the question by some unnerving twit, can God forgive Satan? Respond again saying, I believe a little bit. I like to grind my biases, and here's one about the IRS on Halloween. He comes quietly, curling on with his mustache, darkly, like a cat at night. Oh, not to set the children afright, but careful, stay in your skin. He does have quite a delicate bite. Out of our skin, can that be right? Now, we're not merely trying to be snide. It's just garnering from the very least, there's no place to hide. For the great one's feast, we could all abide. Aren't you glad he's on your side? You think these things, jelly rotten, could not be true? All in all, we love the IRS. Great big beast, you ought to sue. Just remember, get it now. Because everything they have, little ones, belongs to you. I have one about a metric system. I might as well tell you. Metric of the those who can, do. Those who can't, teach. Those who can't teach, push pedometric to each. If something worse there were, wouldn't the way they'd seek to find it, I'm afraid to peek. Oh, Lord, let us leave those who at ease such ill propinquity preach. My magnum opus, couldn't get away without this. I put this up for several weeks, but knowing the topic couldn't be let alone, and I trying to find a little meter, that was the easiest part, about events in Texas, about religion. David K. and the ATFBI. Oh, the tanks are coming through. By the door, by the window, they are coming. And the newspapers and radio and television, too. They're all a-calling. When they can, they're calling back to you. And why we're sure, it's all your fault, we know. The ATFBI has told us so. You're crazy as a bug. Waco, too, we know. You won't leave anybody alone here at all. And shooting guns all night, keeping everybody awake, this we know. The ATFBI has told us so. Cause your guns and ammo, you've got much too much, David boy, for anyone to have. You've caused all the trouble, making noise and scaring everybody. So now you've torched them all, and your friends there are dead, shot to the brain. It's all your fault, they're just a cinder now. Your friends, this we know, the ATFBI has told us so. Oh, Davy boy, oh, Davy boy, we love you so.
Thank you for coming. We'll have to cut this short. I'm sorry. I had planned for an hour, and so thanks for coming. Thank you so much. Susan, that was wonderful.
I really didn't catch it. I got to go talk to
Regular session.
You can catch the end of Shirley McMurrin.
Well, if I had planned for it, would have kept going.
Oh,
because I had to. Oh, next thing.
You heard the story, you were trying to write up into a poem.
I know. Oh, I wish I had known. I'm sorry.
No, I didn't understand what you were talking
about. Oh, wait. No. Right.
Oh, I thought you were talking about it.
Oh, no.
Oh,
no.
Okay.
Oh, sorry. I wish I'd known that.
I was perusing the program. Are you George and Maria? Marty for things like this, and then Martha H. for her work?
Well, I don't know why we did that. I go by both. I mean, you know, when I write something, I usually do Martha. And I don't know why we did that on the... That's what we did. We did Martha D.S.
What did he do again?
I don't know. I guess when I want to be more official, like, yeah. It's sad. James Aaron looked so highly at you. I'm so glad he told me about you.
I was at work on that last night. I was at work on the I don't know if he'll make it tonight. How could he have been there?
So
I went to a real friend. That was really
a nice person.
Yeah, I admire him a lot. Yeah. Very easygoing.
Do you know who Hal is? He's the one that got this Cowboy Porky going up in Elko. Have you ever gone up there? Oh, you would. I mean, some of the sessions are better than others, obviously. But I've gone up there now 2 years in a row. Elko's been up there 3 or 4 years in a row. We get a whole group of people go up there, and it is delightful. Just really, really fun. It's usually in. Let me think for a minute. Hal, when is Cowboy Poetry this year?
Coming? Last week in January.
Okay, last week in January.
In Elko.
It is wonderful. Oh, it's wonderful. You don't even care about how cold you are.
I've heard one called Resurrection.
I've heard it. I don't know. If I have or not. Is that Cowboy Poetry?
Yeah, the guy was burying the flower goes up on his grave and a horse eats it.
Oh, yes, that was red. I bet the Hal's very familiar with that one. Yeah, I remember that one. Some of them read their own, and then some of them are like Hal, which, you know, he read from the book. And, it is, you ought to just make a point of going to that.
Yeah, I already should.
And then they have, it's grown. I mean, there are, I bet 8,000 people would just send on Elko. And this year they spread it out, and there's also music. And in the summer, I didn't get to go this year, but In the summer they have it too. They have a cowboy music festival and then some poetry then too. But he is doing some wonderful things. Well, this year it was in June. Yeah, I missed it.
Do you come down the road for the Temple of Joy
thing? No, I really should. When is it? Last weekend in August? What's it called again?
The Temple of Storytelling Festival. But it's wonderful. They bring in usually three, sometimes four crows. And local people do things in between. They have music guys going on. The crows. They had a guy there 2 years running. And one of the best storytellers I've ever heard. I love good storytelling. This guy's phenomenal. He plays 11 instruments. Spoons, paper bag.
And my husband loved it. Last weekend in August? Mm-hmm. I wonder if the house
is. He tells one story where he manages to bark like a pack of hounds and play harmonica at the same time.
Oh my goodness.
And it was so funny that the second time I watched him, James sat for the last 4 seats. I watched him instead. And the same reaction I did. It's instant shock and laughter.
How much
is it's a very funny skit. I would order him out.
Oh, I'll have to do that. That sounds wonderful.
That is worth coming. Well, we have real research. I've got more in some of the ideas. I don't.
Well, I'm glad you came to this.
Yeah, this is my first time. We got a press release after about a week after I... about 5 days ago. Not a press release. We got a story on the wire. Someone printed it out and brought it over and said, I thought you might want to read it. So I was reading it. The whole thing was fabulous. That's a BYU participation in the broadcast. 92 to 19. I thought, wow. But I knew one of the girls too, who was one of the early editorial people. So I was kind of around. I think that's too bad.
It's been a very hard year to put together.
Oh, BYU's in a bind.
They're in a real hard time. I think the pendulum's got to come back somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, and I come down personally more on the side of the administration than I do on the side of the two faculties who were discharged.
Oh, uh-huh.
But I have a friend of the dean there, who's a department chairman. And he told me about the nature of the vote against Contra Far. There was a swing, apparently, after the initial vote was taken, because some that came up to public was red, and some of the votes went the other way.
I don't know all the details.
But in the end, the decision of tenure is entirely the administration, as you know. I have a friend who works there.
I love this book.
It's no fun to work there. That everything has to so just a double check and pass up the layer that he really is looking to get out. And that really surprised me. He has a job that everyone envies. It's a new tenure. But when I was rewired, I started in 70, left in 77. These questions just didn't come up.
And see, I'm on the side of Contra and Emming Farr and Milton. I mean, I really am. These are wonderful people, and they're
Well, I really I don't believe myself to be chauvinistic in almost any sense. Because I had an intelligent, eloquent mother, and then I had the great misfortune to get to be good friends with a group of people, including girls in high school, and have those friendships. I learned to my surprise that they were capable of intelligent converse and There'll be no junior actor will need part of the honor code. Carol, the boys, but
I haven't taken a class, so I can't get it firsthand knowledge, but I think Cecilia is married. She has two children, one son, and she is not anti-male.
Yeah.
And
so well, you know, like any large organization, also have to be concerned with within the church an unfortunate part of the reality. And with alumni contributions.
Yeah, but you know, the thing is, they hired a feminist scholar, and what do they expect her to do? You know, she's a feminist scholar. And
I think the best thing to do in that respect is to have a department of sermon. Teach one of the classes that he feels are appropriate for her, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And by that I mean not teaching a general education type of class or a basic writing class. If you're going to shell out for a feminist scholar, then set up some feminist classes and I don't know. I have a friend who is minutes away from a doctorate and he'll probably never take a violent intellectual disagreement with his chairman about contemporary music and atonality and all that stuff. He doesn't care for atonality and he wrote stuff with melodies. And they really came down on him. He wouldn't be able to read it unless he rewrote all the pieces. So he can explain for quite a while about that. And the plain fact is, it's music at least. There's an academic area and there's the real world. The academics write pieces for each other that are cold, heartless, by and large, intellectual exercises. That no one really hears, but they're an intellectual exercise like that. And so that's what gives honor between men. But the people who are really writing this and making a living at it are the John Williams who can still read it. And there are some college students who do good work with their few departments. And as my friend pointed out, never in history has a composer, a great composer, been a college teacher first. It's all that way. They all started, you know, in Beethoven.
That's not because it's up there in the mountains of being
So I think some unfortunate things are happening in all the liberal arts because they would all finally disagree with this, but so many of the great ideas we do stuff. And they're floundering, you know. So the part that we consider liberal arts in the old days, that's all been done. And no one's coming with the direction it's going now.
He wants to
get a real weird.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know that much about music, but I am interested in, you know, paintings and art, and I love the postmodern work, and I'm crazy about the way out there. Not all of it, you know, obviously, but.
See, as a general rule, I'm not. But I read an article the other day, in fact, that said much of the 60s art is now falling apart in the end because of the 40s. See, to me, it's a question I deal with all the time. Great. I have little old ladies who have written a song, or a son who's living on a mission, or they've got terminal cancer, pieces coming out of their sleep. I want me to write about what we can arrange. And the pieces are not great music, you know. But the emotions involved in the writing and the motivation of writing is every bit as intense as motivation.
But that's just like Hal's mother's poetry.
And so it's not out. I think in the final analysis, each piece will be judged cosmically. Just a very few criteria. The criteria basically are
really
how well did you do the hotel where you could have done? How well did you do the hotel where you could have done if you lived right?
Hal, thank you so much. I appreciate this.
Thanks. I enjoyed it. I sure enjoyed your comments.
Thank you. Thank you. I enjoyed your stuff very much. I knew you were a true cowboy when you picked up the guitar and sang an acapella song. Cowboy won't sing without the guitar in his hand. Do you know what? Do you know a Stephen Foster tune called Hard Times? Can I get no more?
Yeah. So
I'm madly in love with it. I sang it for someone. They said, bring it. It's a woman tune. It's a song of Sigh of the Mormons. This is what they sing. I love that tune.
The best version I've ever heard of was Sons of the Pioneer.
I love that kind of stuff. You and I have a lot in common because I love that cowboy poetry. Writing from the sky, I've got everything they recorded. Were they?
Yeah, I
missed them. Yes, I would have driven out.
They were here?
We were. Well, that would have been worth going to.
Yeah.
Fun ride there.
Good buddies. They're going to be at our talk again.
Very small. I need to.
You'd enjoy it if you like dog roll.
I love dog roll. And I love good cowboy poetry. I am. Yeah, I just took a hymn off the tape for James Harrington's wife. She collects those hymns and sings them, arranges them very beautifully. She put the words "Oh My Father" to another Foster tune called "Darling Annie." I think. Oh my Father, thou dwellest in a high place. Real pretty. Tons of fun. Yeah, I play bass in a bluegrass group, and we do two writers do. We do the cowboy song and a thing called. There's a blue sky. Great stuff.
That's one they wrote. I think that wrote.
And I admire his yodeling very much. I love yodeling. Anyway, he's the best cowboy I've ever heard.
We'll have some good
I heard that on PBS a while ago at a concert with Michael Brown. Yeah. I was very impressed. Very impressed. I like the old guy's baritone, especially. That's a great voice for cowboy.
Yeah, my mom.